Moreover, she may not be free, and we can hardly launch him into the bosom of a respectable family. Next morning Taverner informed me that his occult methods had enabled him to locate the woman, that she was on Earth, and about 23 years of age. Now we must wait, he said. Sooner or later that tremendous desire of Black's will bring them together. I wonder whether she is conscious yet of the attraction. A few weeks later a Mrs. Tyndall brought her daughter Elaine to consult my colleague. It seemed that the girl was developing delusions. Several times she had roused the household with the announcement that there was a man in her room. She imagined that she heard someone calling her, and used to wander about at night, taking long walks after dark, and often finding herself tired out and miles from home, reduced to finding what conveyance she could for her return. You do not have lapses of memory? Asked Taverner. Never, said the girl. I know exactly where I am and what I am doing. I feel as if I had lost something, and couldn't rest till I had found it. I go out to look for I don't know what. I know it is ridiculous to behave in the way I do, but the impulse is so strong I yield to it in spite of myself. Do you feel any fear of the presence you are conscious of in your room? I did at first, it seemed so strange and uncanny, but now I feel more tantalized than anything else. It is like trying to remember a name that has slipped your memory. Do you know that feeling? I should like to have your daughter under observation in my nursing home, said Taverner to the mother, and I saw by this that he did not regard the case as the commonplace type of insanity it appeared to be. Miss Tyndall was shortly installed at the Hindhead Nursing Home, which was Taverner's headquarters, although he used his Harley Street room for consulting purposes. I liked the girl. She had no pretensions to striking beauty, but she had character. For some time our patient led the life of a normal girl, then one evening she came to me. Dr. Rhodes, she said, I want to take one of my night walks. Will you mind very much if I do? I shall come to no harm, I know what I am doing, but I am so restless I feel that I must move about and get out into open spaces. I spoke to Taverner. I knew of his policy of allowing his patients to follow their whims as far as possible. Let her go by all means, he said. Go with her and see what she does. We cannot let the girl wander about these moors by herself, though I don't suppose she would come to the slightest harm. Miss Tyndall and I went out into the warm darkness of the spring night. She set the pace at a swinging, effortless stride that carried us rapidly over the heather paths. We were climbing towards the heights of Hindhead, and the ascent was trying at the pace we were making. Under the lee of a little pine wood we paused. Listen, said the girl, how still it is. Do you know anything about birds? We have an owl near us at home that hoots on three notes. I have never been able to find out where he is. I often hear him shortly after dusk. We had passed the point where the old coach road crossed the modern metalled highway. Below us was the monument to the memory of the murdered sailor, and above stood the great Celtic cross that gives rest to the souls of hanged men. Far away in the still night a car with open throttle was coming up from Thursley. We watched it as it tore past us, a shadow behind the glare of its headlights. I thought of that wild night ride to the coast, and wondered whether there was another soul in torment who sought to escape by speed from the hell within. The girl at my side suddenly clutched my arm. I feel as if my soul would be torn out of my body, she gasped. I am being drawn into a whirlpool. What is happening? What does it mean? I soothed her as best I could, and we set out upon the walk home. Miss Tyndall was now thoroughly overwrought, starting at every bush. Suddenly she paused listening. Here it comes, she said. Neither she nor I saw anything. But I was as certain as she was that we were not alone. Gypsies are numerous in these parts, I said. It is not gypsies, she answered, it is the presence. I know it quite well. There is no need to be alarmed, it never does any harm. But isn't it a curious feeling? She paused and looked at me, her face tense in the uncertain light that precedes moonrise. There is something I want, Dr. Rhodes. I don't know what it is. But I shall go on wanting it till I die, and never want anything else. If I do not find it, Then I shall know that I have lived my life in vain. When we returned, we found that Taverner was out. An accident had occurred at the Hindhead crossroads, the local doctors were not available, and Taverner, although he took no part in the general practice of the neighborhood, had been telephoned for to give first aid. Miss Tindall wished me good night and went to her room, and I was debating whether I would go to bed when the telephone bell rang. "That you, Rhodes?" said Taverner's voice. "I am bringing a man back here. Will you have a bed made up for a surgical case?" It was not long before I heard the car outside, and helped to unload the improvised stretcher. "Another curious coincidence," said Taverner, with the one-sided smile he reserved for skepticism, and I saw that the man we were lifting was Arnold Black. "Then it was his car we heard on the Portsmouth Road," I cried. "Very likely," said Taverner. "He was driving at his usual gait, failed to negotiate the crossroads, and rolled down the bank into the bushes." "The steering gear must have gone wrong," I said. "Or the man's mind," said Taverner. "We got our patient into bed and were settling him down for the night, when a nurse came along to say that Miss Tindall was in a very excited state. We left the woman in charge of Black and went along to the girl's bedroom. We found her sitting up in bed excited, as the nurse had said, but still mistress of herself. 'It is the presence,' she said. 'It is so strong that I feel as if at any moment I might see something.' Taverner lowered the light. 'Let us see if we can get a look at it,' he observed. 'It is a peculiarity of a mystic that his presence stimulates the psychic faculties of those he is with, and Taverner was a mystic of no ordinary type. I have nothing of the mystic in my makeup, but when astral entities are about, I am conscious of a sensation such as we considered in childhood to be due to a goose walking over one's grave. Taverner would often describe to me the appearance of the thing that gave rise to these sensations as it presented itself to his trained sight, and after a little practice I found that, although I was seldom able to see anything, I could locate the direction whence the vibrations came. As we waited in the darkened room, I became conscious of this sensation, and then Taverner exclaimed, 'Look, Rhodes, even you must see this, for it is the etheric double coming out of the physical body.' Beside the girl on the bed, a coffin-shaped drift of grey mist was spreading itself. As we watched it, I saw it take form, and I could trace the distinct outline of a human figure. Slowly the features grew clear, and I recognized the lean red Indian countenance of Arnold Black. The girl rose on her elbow and stared in astonishment at the form beside her. Then with a cry she sought to gather the grey drift into her arms. 'It has come, it has come,' she cried. 'Look! I can see it. It is real.' But the impalpable stuff eluded her, her hands passed through it as through a fog wreath, and with a cry of distress she hung over the form she could not hold. 'What does it all mean?' I asked Taverner. 'It means death if we can't get it back,' he said. 'That is Black's etheric double, what you would call his ghost, the subtle body that carries the life forces. It is inspired by emotions, and, being freed for the time, has come to the object of its desires, the reborn soul of the woman he loved in the past. The astral body has often been here before. It was that of which she was conscious when she felt what she calls the presence, but it has never previously been able to come in such a definite form as this. It means that Black is on the point of death. We must see if we can induce this grey shape to re-enter its house of flesh.' Taverner laid his hand on the girl's shoulder, compelling her attention. 'Come with me,' he said. 'I cannot leave it,' she replied, again seeking to gather up the shadowy form on the bed. 'It will follow you,' said Taverner. Meekly the girl rose. I put her dressing gown over her shoulders and Taverner held open the door for her. She preceded us into the passage, the grey mist wreath drifting after her, its outlines merged in a shapeless fog. It was no longer horizontal but upright, looking like a sheet held up by the corner. The girl moved ahead of us down the passage. With her hand on the door of the room where Black lay, she paused, then she entered, and started back in confusion as the light of a nightlight revealed the form of a man in the bed. I beg your pardon, she faltered, and sought to retreat, but Taverner pushed her ahead of him and closed the door. He led her gently to the bed. "Have you ever seen this man before?" he asked. "Never," she replied, staring with a curious fascination at the set face on the pillow. "Look straight into yourself, face your naked soul, and tell me what he is to you." Taverner's will compelled her, and the veneer of today fell away from her. The greater self that had come down through the ages stirred, woke, and for the moment took control of the lesser personality. A man's life and the fate of two souls hung in the balance, and Taverner forced the girl to face the issue. "Look down into your deeper self and tell me what this man is to you." "Everything." The girl faced him, breathing as if she had run a race. "What will you do for him?"
"Everything."
"Think well before you pledge yourself, for if you bring that soul back into the body and then fail it, you will have committed a very grievous sin."
"I could not fail it if I tried," replied the girl.
"Something stronger than myself compels me." "Then bid the soul re-enter the body and live again."
"Is he dead?"
"Not yet, but his life hangs by a thread. Look, you can see it." We looked, and saw that the silvery strand of mist connected the grey wraith with the body on the bed. "How can I make him re-enter his body?"
"Focus your mind on the body and he will be attracted back into it."
Slowly, hesitatingly, she bent over the unconscious man and gathered the bruised and broken body into her arms. Then, as we watched, the grey drifting mist drew nearer and was gradually absorbed into the physical form. Black and Elaine Tyndall were married from the nursing home 6 weeks later, and left for their honeymoon in the racing car that had been salved from the bushes. There was nothing wrong with the steering gear. As we returned to the house after watching their departure, I said to Taverner, "Most men would say you had mated a couple of lunatics whose delusions happened to match."
"And most men would have certified the pair of them for an asylum," replied Taverner.
"All I have done has been to recognize the working of two great natural laws, and you see the result."
"How did you piece this story together?"
I inquired.
"It was fairly simple," said Taverner, "as simple as human nature ever is. You know my method. I believe that we have many lives and can influence others by our thoughts, and I find that my belief will often throw light where ordinary ideas fail. Now take the case of Black. The ordinary doctor would have said it was his subconscious mind that was playing him tricks.
Well, it might have been, so I took the trouble to read the history of his past lives in what we call the Akashic Records, where all thoughts are recorded. I found that in several previous lives he had been associated with an individual of the opposite sex, and that in his last life he had had the presumption to bid for her favor when she was a princess of the royal house and he was a soldier of fortune. As a reward for his daring, he was flung from the roof of the palace and dashed to death on the stones of the courtyard. Now you can understand why it was that the spinning nose dive wakened old memories he had plunged to his death before. You can also see why he felt as if his tummy had dropped out when he saw the pictures of Egypt, for it was in an Egyptian existence that all this took place. There are a great many people alive at the present time who have had an Egyptian past. We seem to be running into a cycle of them. You can also see the reason of Black's love of speed. It wakes dim memories of his last contact with the soul he was seeking. If he could retrace his steps to the point where he swooped into space, he would be able to pick up the trail of the woman of his desire. He was prompted to reproduce as nearly as possible the conditions in which he had last known her. As I have already told you, the memories woke, and Black set forth on his quest for the woman he had been mated with life after life, and having seen in the occult records their repeated union, I knew it was only a matter of time till they came together, and I sincerely hoped that she, too, would remember the past and be free to marry him. If she had not, we should have had, as I warned you, a very nasty mess. These spiritual ties are the devil. Now, I expect you wonder what chance it was that brought Elaine Tyndall to me. I knew, as I told you, that sooner or later their paths would meet. Well, I placed myself mentally at the point of their meeting. Consequently, as time drew near, they converged upon me, and it was my privilege to steer them to harbor. But what about Miss Tyndall and her delusions? I inquired.
It looked to you like a commonplace case of old maid's insanity, didn't it? Said Taverner. But the girl's self-possession and absence of fear led me to suspect something more. She was so very definite and impersonal in her attitude towards her delusions. So I arranged for her to come down to Hindhead and let me try whether or not I could see what she saw. What we saw, you yourself know. It was Black shaken out of his body by the shock of the accident and drawn to her by the intensity of his longing, not at all an uncommon phenomenon. I have often seen it. How did you manage to get Black to re-enter his body, provided he had ever been out of it? When Elaine touched his body, the soul of Black realized that it could meet her in the flesh, and so sought to re-enter its own body, but the vitality was so low it could not manage it. If the girl had not held him in her arms as she did, he would have died, but he lived on her vitality till he was able to build up his own. I can see the psychological end of it, I said, but how do you account for the chances that brought them together? Why should Miss Tyndall have become restless and made for the Portsmouth Road, timing her arrival to fit in with Black's passing? Taverner looked up at the stars that were just beginning to show in the darkening sky. Ask them, he said. The ancients knew what they were about when they cast horoscopes. End of this story, and next is the soul that would not be born. Contrary to his usual custom, Taverner did not insist on seeing his patient alone, for the sufficient reason that no information could be extracted from her. It was to the mother, a Mrs. Cayley, we turned for the case history, and she, poor anxious woman, gave us such scanty details as an onlooker might observe. But of the viewpoint and feelings of the patient we learned nothing, for there was nothing to learn. She sat before us in the big leather armchair. Her body was a tenement for the soul of a princess, but it was, alas, untenanted. The fine dark eyes, utterly expressionless, looked into space while we discussed her as if she had been an inanimate object, which practically she was. She was never like ordinary children, said the mother. When they put her in my arms after she was born, she looked up at me with the most extraordinary expression in her eyes. They were not a baby's eyes at all, doctor. There were the eyes of a woman, and an experienced woman too. She didn't cry, she never made a sound, but she looked as if she had all the troubles of the world upon her shoulders. That baby's face was a tragedy. Perhaps she knew what was coming. Perhaps she did, said Taverner. In a few hours, however, continued the mother, she looked quite like an ordinary baby, but from that time to this she has never changed, except in her body. We looked at the girl in the chair, and she gazed back at us with the unblinking stolidity of a very young infant. We have taken her to everybody we could hear of, but they all say the same, that it is a hopeless case of mental deficiency. But when we heard of you, we thought you might say something different. We knew that your methods were not like those of most doctors. It does seem strange that it should be impossible to do anything for her. We passed some children playing in the street as we came here in the car, bonny, bright little things, but in such rags and dirt. Why is it that those, whose mothers can do so little for them, should be so splendid, and Mona, for whom we would do anything, should be as she is? The poor woman's eyes filled with tears, and neither Taverner nor I could reply. I will take her down to my nursing home and keep her under observation for a time, if you wish, said Taverner. If the brain is at fault, I can do nothing, but if it is the mind itself that has failed to develop, I might attempt the cure. These deficiency cases are so inaccessible, it is like ringing up on the telephone when the subscriber will not answer. If one could attract her attention, something might be done. The crux of the matter lies in the establishment of communications. When they had gone, I turned to Taverner and said, what hope have you in dealing with a case like that? I cannot tell you just yet, he replied. I shall have to find out what her previous incarnations have been. I invariably find that congenital troubles originate in a former life. Then I shall have to work out her horoscope and see whether the conditions are ripe for the paying off of whatever debt she may have incurred in a previous life. Do you still think I am a queer sort of charlatan, or are you beginning to get used to my ways? I have long ceased to be astonished at anything, I replied. I should accept the devil, horns, hoofs and tail, if you undertook to prescribe for him. Taverner chuckled. With regard to our present case, I am of the opinion that we shall find the law of reincarnation is the one we shall have to look to. Now tell me this, Rhodes, supposing reincarnation is not a fact, supposing this life is the beginning and end of our existence and at its conclusion we proceed to flames or harps according to the use we have made of it, how do you account for Mona Cayley's condition? What did she do in the few hours between her birth and the onset of her disease to bring down such a judgment on herself? And at the end of her life, can she justly be said to have deserved hell or earned heaven? I don't know, said I. But supposing my theory is right, then, if we can recover the record of her past, we shall be able to find the cause of her present condition, and having found the cause we may be able to remedy it. At any rate, let us try. Would you like to see how I recover the records? I use various methods. Sometimes I get them by hypnotizing the patients or by crystal gazing, and sometimes I read them from the subconscious mind of nature. You know, we believe that every thought and impulse in the world is recorded in the Akashic records. It is like consulting a reference library. I am going to use the latter method in the present case. In a few moments, by methods known to himself, Taverner had shut out all outward impressions from his mind, and was concentrated upon the inner vision. Confused mental pictures evidently danced before his eyes. Then he got the focus and began to describe what he saw while I took down notes. Egyptian and Grecian lives were dismissed with a few words. These were not what he sought. He was merely working his way down through the ages. But I gathered that we were dealing with a soul of ancient lineage and great opportunities. Life after life we heard the tale of royal birth or initiation into the priesthood, and yet, in its present life, the girl's soul was cut off from all communication with its physical vehicle. I wondered what abuse of opportunity had led to such a sentence of solitary confinement in the cell of its body. Then we came to the level we sought, Italy in the 15th century, as it turned out. Daughter of the reigning duke. I could not catch the name of his principality. Her younger sister was beloved by Giovanni Sigmondi. She contrived to win the affections of her sister's lover, and then, a richer suitor offering for her own hand, she betrayed Sigmondi to his enemies in order to be free of his importunities. A true daughter of the Renaissance, said Taverner when he had returned to normal consciousness and read my notes. For he seldom retained any memory of what transpired during his subconscious states. Now I think we can guess the cause of the trouble. I wonder whether you are aware of the mental processes that precede birth. Just before birth the soul sees a cinematograph film, as it were, of its future life, not all the details, but the broad outlines which are determined by its fate. These things it cannot alter, but according to its reaction to them, so will its future lives be planned. Thus it is that although we cannot alter our fate in this life, our future lies entirely in our own hands. Now we know the record, we can guess what manner of fate lies upon this girl. She owes a life debt to a man and a woman, the suffering she caused recoils upon her. There is no need for a specialized hell, each soul builds its own. But she is not suffering, I said, she is merely in a passive condition. The only one who suffers is the mother. Ah, said Taverner, therein lies the crux of the whole matter. When she had that brief glimpse of what lay before her, she rebelled against her fate and tried to repudiate her debt. Her soul refused to take up the heavy burden. It was this momentary flash of knowledge which gave her eyes their strange, unchildlike look which so startled her mother. Do people always have this foreknowledge? I asked. They always have that glimpse, but its memory usually lies dormant. Some people have vague premonitions, however, and occult training tends to recover these lost memories, together with others belonging to previous lives. Having found out the cause of Miss Cayley's trouble, what can you do to cure her? Very little, said Taverner. I can only wait and watch her. When the time is ripe for the settlement of the balance, the other actors in the old tragedy will come along and unconsciously claim the payment of their debt. She will be given the opportunity of making restitution and going on her way fate-free. If she is unable to fulfill it, then she will be taken out of life and rapidly forced back into it again for another attempt. But I think, since she has been brought to me, her soul is to be given another chance of entering its body. We will see. I often used to watch Mona Kaylee after she was installed at the Hindhead nursing home. In spite of its mask-like expressionlessness, her face had character. The clearly cut features, firm mouth, and fine eyes were fitting abode for a soul of no ordinary caliber, only that soul was not present. It was Taverner's expectation that the other actors in the drama would appear upon the scene before very long, brought to the girl's vicinity by those strange currents that are forever on the move beneath the surface of life. As each new patient arrived at the nursing home, I used to watch Mona Kaylee narrowly, wondering whether the newcomer would demand of her the payment of the ancient debt that held her bound. Spring passed into summer and nothing happened. Other cases distracted my attention, and I had almost forgotten the girl and her problems when Taverner reminded me of them. "It is time we began to watch Miss Kaylee," he said. "I have been working out her horoscope, and a conjunction of planets is taking place towards the end of the month, which would provide an opportunity for the working out of her fate if we can get her to take it. Supposing she does not take it? Then she will not be long in going out, for she will have failed to achieve the purpose of this incarnation. And supposing she takes it? Then she will suffer, but she will be free, and she will soon rise again to the heights she had previously gained. She is hardly likely to belong to a royal house in this life," I said. "She was more than royal, she was an initiate," replied Taverner, and from the way he said the word I knew he spoke of a royalty that is not of this earth. Our words were suddenly interrupted by a cry from one of the upper rooms. It was a shriek of utter terror such as a soul might give that had looked into chaos and seen forbidden horrors. It was the cry of a child in nightmare, only and this added to its ghastliness, it came from the throat of a man. We rushed upstairs. We had no need to ask whence that cry came. There was only one case that could have uttered it, a poor fellow suffering from shell shock whom we were keeping in bed for a rest. We found him standing in the middle of the floor, shaking from head to foot. At sight of us he rushed across and flung himself into Taverner's arms. It was the pathetic action of a frightened child, but carried out by the tall figure in striped pajamas. It was extraordinarily distressing to witness. Taverner soothed him as gently as a mother, and got him back to bed, sitting by him until he quieted down. "I do not think we will keep him in bed any longer," said my colleague after we had left the room. "The inactivity is making him brood, and he is living over again the scenes of the trenches." Accordingly, Howson appeared among the patients next day for the first time since his arrival, and seemed to benefit by the change. Hours, until my colleague put his hand on my shoulder one evening as the two were crossing the lawn towards the house. "Who is that with Mona Kaylee?" he asked. "Howson, of course," I replied, surprised at the obviousness of such a question. "So we call him now," said Taverner, watching the pair closely. "But I think there was a time when he answered to the name of Giovanni Sigmundi."
"You mean?" I exclaimed.
"Exactly," said Taverner. "The wheel has come round the full circle. When he was dying by torture in the hands of those to whom she betrayed him, he called for her in his agony. Needless to say, she did not come. Now that he is in agony again, some strange law of mental habit carried the call for help along the old channels. And she has answered it. She has begun to repay her debt. If all goes well, we may see that soul come right back into its body, and it will not be a small soul that comes into the flesh if that happens. I had thought that we were going to witness a romance of reunited lovers, but I was soon made aware that it was more likely to be a tragedy for one at least of them." Next day Howson's fiancée arrived to visit him. I took her out to the secluded part of the garden where he spent his time, and there saw enacted a most pathetic little tragicomedy. As usual, Howson was at Mona Kaylee's side, smoking his interminable cigarettes. At sight of his fiancée he sprang to his feet. Mona Kaylee also rose. In the eyes of the newcomer there were fear and distrust, perhaps occasioned by her unfamiliarity with mental cases, which are always distressing at first sight, But in the eyes of our defective there was a look which I can only describe as contempt. There was one flash of the astute ruthlessness of the 15th century Italian, and I guessed who the newcomer was.